right. Good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It's 1:37 on the 20th of April. Thank you, Senator Sauer, for being here, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Costello, Chair Coghill. My expectation is Senator Kelly will be here along shortly. We have several things I'd like to do today. I'm going to bring up 355 first, which is the forest fireland bill, and we'll talk about amendments there. We had to lay it aside while we did other business last time. House Bill 208 will be laid aside at this point. We'll take up House Bill 123 next. We'll do the public testimony. We have a CS to adopt. We'll do the adoption, then we'll do the public testimony, and then we'll have the sponsors sit in front of us. If time if time permits, House Bill 259, confining vehicle loads, will be introduced today, as well as House Bill 336, supportive decision-making agreements. My expectation is that we'll hear them today and take them up Monday, which brings me to that announcement. I asked my leadership team if I could keep moving through to have a Monday meeting, which case we'll take up 259 and 336 and other bills if need be. At this point, we're going to take up if there anything else before the committee at this point? At this point, we'll take up the House Bill 355. And we do have Aliana with us, who is from Staff Guttenberg, Staff to Representative Guttenberg. We have Chris Mache, who's Division Forestry. Senator Sauer wanted to bring up a motion on the amendment number 3 that had been before us. Senator Sauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to move to rescind amendment number 3, and I'll be moving to add a new amendment.
I think the proper motion is to rescind our action in passing amendment number 3.
That sounds good.
Is there any objection to rescinding our action and passing amendment number 3? That brings amendment number 3 before us then. And you want to speak to amendment number 3?
Just the rescinding it.
You want to go ahead and fail to pass it is what you want to do? If we can fail to pass it at this point, which would allow you to bring up another amendment.
That sounds good.
Is there any objection to... I think probably because we voted for amendment number 3, my expectation is if the member wants to withdraw it, he can withdraw it at this point. Is that your pleasure?
That would be correct.
Any objection to withdrawing amendment number 3? All right. Amendment number 3 then will be withdrawn under our rescinding action. And Senator Sauer, that was your attempt to bring us to a different amendment.
That is correct.
And that would be... if you want to move that amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 028.
028, which would be amendment number what?
7.
This will be number 6, because the other one had not been offered
yet.
So this will be amendment number 6. And I'll object so that we can hear your discussion on this amendment number 60.28.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What we have done in rescinding the previous one that we just took action on is an agreement between my office and the Division of Forestry, the bill sponsor, and the Department of Law to essentially, even though the reason I brought up the first one was I felt the definition was too broad for activities, other activities or land use, to keep it consistent with the other sections within the draft document. It still meets the intent of keeping it consistent, but our intent was also to tighten the language so that for example, as some of the things were brought up, you know, mowing your lawn and having a citation written for that or being held responsible, chainsaw somewhere out in Glen Allen and somebody's property with a slash pile. So what this does, if you look at page 3, line 9, following regulation, we would insert under A of this section. So essentially what it would sound like now is a person may not set fires, use burning devices, or conduct other activities or use land that increases fire danger without a permit as prescribed by the commissioner in regulation under A of this section. And what that essentially does is allows, if you go back to previous sections, it means that whatever he puts into regulation is what an inspector would have to stick to, so they couldn't just make up a new category and say, I'm going to fine you for using your lawnmower. So I believe it meets the intent on both sides, and so therefore I would move to pass this amendment in
place. Aliana, you want to have a brief at ease real quick while we look up the statute?
Yeah.
Bring the committee back to order. First, we'll ask Aliana, and then I see Chris Mace, you got your legal team here, so yes. We can go there. Aliana, is that something that you've been agreeable to on this amendment?
For the record, Aliana Slungate, staff to Representative Gwenberg. Senator Coghill, yes, this was an agreement we made with Senator Shower's office, and we support this language.
So then, Chris, can you explain the effect that it has, and then we can go to the legal question? Well, do you want to have the legal question answered first?
Yeah, that probably would be best. And then
so put yourself on the record. And
for the record, this is Ann Nelson with the Alaska Department of Law.
Okay, thanks, Ann. So the effect of this is we're inserting that it would be under the A section of the 4115.
Yes, Senator Coghill, the added language clarifies that the permit enforcement authority is, in fact, limited to activities for which a permit is required.
Okay. Welcome to Senator Kelly. Senator Kelly, we're under Amendment Number 6, which we're just now getting the explanation to, which clarifies the regulatory authority, as I understand it. Mr. Mace, what would be your expectation under this as far as rulemaking? Does this help? Or does it just point to that authority? Tell us what this practically does for your regulation making.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Chris Mace, Director of the Division of Forestry. And Mr. Chairman, yes, this would make this a much tighter statute and tie it directly back to the regulation process. And that would be through the commissioner and all the normal public processes that need to be followed. Right. When you do that type of activity.
So the value would be a more public process rather than a...
Correct, and keep that enforcement piece tied right. together with it.
Okay. So we have Amendment Number 6 before us. We've got the explanation. Is there questions from the committee since I started the questioning? Any objection to Amendment Number 6 passing? Seeing no objection then, Amendment Number 6 will pass. Is there any other amendments for the CS for House Bill 55?
I have one question, Mr. Chairman, if I could.
There is a question that Senator Shower would like to ask.
We had the reason I withdrew my original Amendment Number 6 was for a backfire burn for excluding citizens if they did it on their own. However, discussing this with the Division of Forestry, the Department of Law, and the bill sponsor, we agreed that if they were willing to give us public testimony briefly to say why that a citizen that was directed by a state official would still be excluded under the law, that I was happy with that and I would withdraw the amendment. So if you would give us the latitude for them to give the reasoning, I would be happy and be done.
Sure. Is that something that you'd want to do, Mr. Mace?
Mr. Chair, I'd ask that Ann do the first part and I'll do the second part of it.
Okay, Ann Nelson, put yourself on the record and give us the answer to that question.
I'm Ann Nelson with the Alaska Department of Law. Through the chair, as Senator Shower has indicated, the immunity statute in existing law at 41 AS 4115.045 would apply to a homeowner or other member of the public who is directed to take certain activity by a federal or state fire official. So the civil immunity statute would apply to individual citizens acting at the direction of a federal or state fire official under the existing statute.
All right. And practically speaking, pull that microphone around a little closer to you. Thank you.
You bet. And then I would like to add to that that we've also made a commitment that as we roll out the new provisions that this bill would provide, that we will include training material, educational material to the public so that they understand that that's clearly an option that is afforded under the conditions Ann just outlined. And we'll also be doing a lot of educational work about the bail schedule and some other parts of the bill should it pass.
Excellent. Thank you. Just for the committee's information, we have Tom Kurth, who's also a fire program manager with the Division of Forestry, and we have Aaron Peterson, who's the Department of Law with the Criminal Division in Anchorage, available to answer questions. But it sounds like on this particular issue we're answered. So any other amendments at this point? Thank you for that clarifying remarks. That will bring the CS, House Bill 355, as amended before us. Senator Costello, you want to make a motion and see if we can debate this thing out of here?
Mr. Chair, I move CS for House Bill number 355, Judiciary, as amended, version Oscar, out of committee with individual committee recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Brief it is. Is it? We had the wrong version. Can we restate that motion, please?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 355, Judiciary Amended Version Uniform, from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
And since we have that, I'm going to add that the understanding is that it's conforming technical changes since their amendments were happening on the fly. So is there objection to moving the bill as amended? With individual recommendations, attached fiscal note, and conforming technical changes to the department. Seeing no objection, then we will move the House Bill 355 from committee with individual recommendations. Let's take a brief ease while we sign this document. Thank you. Right. The next item on today's calendar is House Bill 123. We have a lot of people set up for testimony today, so we're going to do that. But before we do, I wanted to adopt the CS, go through the CS, get any comments from the sponsor, and then we'll go to public testimony. And I'd have one amendment that I will pass out to the committee members once we get the CS adopted. But I wanted to get the CS, the sponsor, and in public testimony. So, Madam Costello, could you adopt the Q version? I'll object so we can have a discussion on it.
I move to adopt Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 127, Judiciary version Quebec, before the committee as a working document.
And I'll object, and I'll apologize. I was about to say Madam Chair, and then Senator didn't come up, so, you know.
I can change, I guess.
The staff to the Judiciary Committee will go through the CS and the changes in it, and then we'll have the discussion with the sponsor. Mr. Schilling.
For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. Page 2 of version Q is where you'll find the first change. You'll notice that the price disclosure that is required to be posted no longer will reflect the Medicaid price. It will simply reflect the undiscounted price.
Okay.
Second substantive change in the CS is that the requirement for a healthcare facility to post 50 commonly done procedures will now post 25. That's also on page 2. The third change is on page 4. Insurers were removed from the requirements under subsection H. They no longer have to comply with the components of H that will be a part of the good faith estimate.
Would you restate that, please?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Page 4, line 22, which is subsection H,
Okay. Previously
required that providers, facilities, and insurers comply with this section. The CS eliminates the requirement that insurers comply with this section. I can explain further, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like.
There probably should explain that a little bit.
Sure. So there were a few elements of subsection H that the insurers, primarily Premera and Aetna, contacted us about, saying that they wouldn't be able to comply with. They said they would have difficulty providing the procedure code.
without the help of a provider or the patient themselves giving it to them. Further, Primera identified H5 as information that they similarly could not provide to someone as a part of a good faith estimate. And this is the identity or suspected identity of any other person that may charge the patient for a service, product, procedure, or supply in connection with the healthcare services included in the estimate. And so we do have a representative from Primera that's online that can go further into that if needed.
No, no, I just wanted to make it clear. So thanks for restating it and then continue.
Finally, Mr. Chairman, page 6 of the bill, under the definition of healthcare facility, you'll see on line 26 that a facility operated by an Alaska Tribal Health Organization has been exempted from this definition, thereby exempting those organizations from the requirements under this bill.
And this is where I had to go to a previous chairman and indulge him to forgive me, because it became very, very clear that we were going to end up with a federal preemption issue that that I just felt we needed to bring to light. Mr. Schilling, that's it?
And that's it, Mr. Chairman.
All right. And so we do have the Representative Sponholz here. And did you want to make any comment on it at this point, or just...
Yeah, thank you, Chair Coghill. The only comment that I'll make is, you know, I appreciate the ability to work with your office on the committee substitute. I have a minor concern about the amendment that reduces the number of prices required to be listed by a facility from 50 to 20. That means that any hospital would list only 25 services. I believe that that concern is ameliorated by an amendment that I believe is coming. And
yeah,
so
and if I may, Representative, I agree with you, and what we did is we went and got an amendment drafted up that we brought up to you that we thought may help be helpful, and what we'll do is we'll take under the current listing six sections of the Category 1 procedural terminology, and we'll take 10 of each of those six categories and make them available, and we'll just I wanted to say it out loud as you and I were talking. We wanted to make the information as relevant as possible, and in the discussions with you and many other people throughout this, relevant information is going to be kind of the big importance. So as we go through, I wanted to bring you forward on that because we're going to have some public testimony, and this might give some change to the testimony. We'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thank you, Chair Coghill. I just wanted to be clear that that I support the bill with the amendment, which hasn't been introduced yet, but so I wanted to clarify that nuance there. So thank you.
It's a work in progress.
It is, absolutely.
And I appreciate you working with me, because my first answer was no, and you graciously got very tenacious.
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment.
So with that, we're going to go ahead and go to public testimony. And we had people sign in as early as 1:20, so we have people in Anchorage, people in Seattle, and we're going to go, and Mr. Schilling, make sure that I have the signed-in testimony in the room. First thing we're going to do, though, is we have, it looks like, about 20 people to testify. So that is means I'll have to keep it as tight as I can. But I want to make sure that people have ample time to make their case and give their testimony. So I'm going to try to keep it under 3 minutes if I can. So we have Gina Osnakis, if I got it right, who is in Anchorage. Gina?
Yes. Oh, speaker. Yeah. Chairman Coghill and members of the committee, thank you for taking the time to listen to me today. Are you hearing me okay?
Very fine. Put your name on the record, Gina.
My name is Gina Bosnakis, B-O-S-N-A-K-I-S.
I'm
a lifelong Alaskan, born in Fairbanks in 1958. Then I moved to Anchorage in 1976, where I've remained. I'm a small business owner, and I've been in the Alaskan employee benefits industry for over 30 years. One of the major parts of my job is working with my clients, employees, and their family members. So often when I receive a call from someone who believes they've had a claim handled improperly, I can identify the problem And it's usually something simple like a provider using the wrong code. And then I have it processed and paid properly. And I'd say outside of a death claim, the most difficult part of my job is when I receive a call from a patient who really thought they'd done everything they were supposed to do to make sure they were getting their procedure from the right doctor or facility. But often the question that the patient will ask the provider is, do you accept Premier or whoever the insurance company is, and the provider will say that they do. But the proper question is, are you a preferred provider or in network with? And if the answer to that is no, it changes the whole dynamic for the patient. Excuse me, Representative Sponheld's bill gives the patients ammunition to find out exactly what their out-of-pocket expenses will be by answering in large enough type to read if the provider is in-network with their insurance company and what the procedure code for the recommended treatment will be. If the provider is in-network with the insurance company, those two pieces of information will arm the patient with the knowledge they need to find out from their insurance company exactly or very close to what their out-of-pocket expenses will be. If the provider is not in-network with the insurance company, the patient is then armed with the knowledge that their out-of-pocket expenses will almost certainly be much more than what they had anticipated. And then they can and probably should consider other options available to them, such as traveling outside of the state for their care. Most insurance companies in Alaska offer that option at the same or lower cost to the patient than staying in Alaska. Now, as an Alaskan, and particularly as a business owner, it's really difficult for me to even consider suggesting someone get a service from outside of my state that can be provided in Alaska. But in this circumstance, that decision may save a family from lifelong debt and stress at a time that they least need it. There's a number of reasons why the healthcare costs in Alaska have gotten so out of whack, but Representative Sponholz's bill, if it becomes law as written now, will absolutely save a lot of Alaskans from unnecessary debt and potentially curb the high cost for healthcare and then therefore health insurance in Alaska. I appreciate the time you have allowed me to speak with you. I believe with all of my heart, if this becomes law, its positive impact will be felt in every city, borough, and village in our state.
Gina, thank you very much for taking your time to come and testify. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
We're going to go to Jennifer Mayhoff at this point in Anchorage.
Good afternoon, Chairman Coghill and committee members. Thank you for allowing me to take a minute. My name is Jennifer Mayhoff. I am a principal with Marshall McLennan Agency, which is part of Marshall McLennan Company, the worldwide consulting firm. I'm also a lifelong Alaskan based in Anchorage. I have over 25 years of experience working with employers, large and small, all sizes, public and private, on their employee benefits and what can be affordable. I'm happy to address some questions today, but I'd like you to think about yourself in the market for various goods and services in an average day. So you wake up at home, you need to head to Juneau. You pull out of the garage, you notice your car needs gasoline. You glance down the street and see the station on the street on the left is offering you gas for $2.59, but the station on the right says it sells you a gallon for $2.54. Think for a moment about the complexity of exploring for oil, finding it, producing it, transporting it, refining it, transporting a refined product, marketing it, and still they tell you to the penny what the price is before you buy it. That's just one of many examples that I'm sure you could relate to. All throughout the day, in virtually every aspect of your life, you are a participant in a market in exchange of goods and services. Where the price of the good or the service is known and communicated before that transaction. Every aspect of your life, except when you go to the doctor or the hospital. We've heard the medical providers can't disclose the prices because it's just too complicated. I'm here to say that there are a lot of complicated goods and services in our marketplace, and somehow they figure it out. Much needs to be done to help rebalance the healthcare marketplace, and HB 123 is an important part of that rebalance. We need to empower consumers with information to make economic decisions, just like the information most everyone else gives you to make economic decisions throughout your average day. I think you'd agree that your constituents made a good decision when they voted for you. Please pass HB 123. It will give them the opportunity to make good decisions about their health care. I believe that for the most part, those decisions will be rational and that in the end, it will help us start to contain the cost of health care. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jennifer, very much for your testimony today. We also have Leonard Sorin with Premera Blue Cross in Seattle, who's here available for questions, and Catherine Kurtz, who's with the Office of Administrative Hearing in Juneau for questions. So just for the committee, be aware. We also have Lori Winghire, who's here with DCED, Division of Insurance, and we have Heidi Langdorfer with Department of Health and Social Services, and Deb Eldridge with Juneau with DHSS. But we're going to move through testimony at this point. We have in Fairbanks, Sean Lewis.
Yes. My name is Sean Lewis, and I have been a businessman and in the health insurance industry as well for over the last 25 years. And I appreciate the opportunity, Congressman Coghill, or Senator Coghill, and your constituents that are there. House Bill 123 is a good bill because it's good for businesses to have transparency. I'm not going to rehash the things that have already been said, but the thing that I found is that every client that I work with in the health industry has found that they are in that competition as well. So when they've got skin in the game, and that's what this will do, is provide them the opportunity to be responsible for looking at why does Dr. XYZ charge more than Dr. ABC, and they can have that conversation with them. I'm all for the open market out there. But I think it's good that the patient has that control, at least to be able to have that conversation and make those decisions, whether that's going to be good for them or not. As we all know, competition is good. We also know that in Alaska, there is a smaller access to market. And it does make it tough when you've only got one carrier or whatever. Obviously, if we have more options, that's a good thing. It is a fairly, well, I shouldn't say simple process, but to keep it to 25 procedures, I think, is a good step in the right direction. Now, to the physician's concern about this bill, I'm well aware that this is not a silver bullet that's going to magically going to suddenly drive the cost down, but it's a good start. And as you know, healthcare reform is a marathon, and a marathon's what, 26 miles? And this is just miles 1, 2, and 3. As a member of the community and talking to our businesses, I know that they are in full support of something like this because they all want to at least to have some skin in the game. And again, healthcare is a major problem for everybody. You know, with the cost of healthcare going up every year, everybody's going to have to give a little, whether it be doctors, whether it be insurance carriers, or whether it be patients. And I think, again, this is just a good step in the right direction. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sean, very much. Appreciate you taking your time to testify mid-Friday afternoon. We're going to go to Terry, is it Allard or Allard, with the Alaska Association of Healthcare Underwriters.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Coghill, for giving me this opportunity. My name is Terry Allard. I am a senior benefits advisor at the Wilson Agency in Anchorage. I have been in the industry for over 30 years, and I, too, want to express my support for the for this bill. Today I'm testifying as a representative for the Alaska Association of Health Underwriters. I am the co-chair of our legislative committee. We have been dealing with an issue in our state with the very high cost of health insurance for years. In fact, some might say that we are reaching a crisis with the rate increases that we are having to present to our clients on a daily basis. I've had a lot of conversations in the last few years with clients who ask me about why are the expenses so high and what can we do about it. There is no one single solution to this problem. But a starting point, we believe, is giving the consumers the tools that they need to behave like consumers. and that starts with having access to the information that we've been talking about today, that they need to get from their providers so that they can make informed decisions about when they get services, who they get services from, and how they want to deal with that in their own personal budgets. Again, I've been asked on a very regular basis by my clients, why isn't the legislature doing something to help us with this? We believe, from the conversations that we've had with legislators, that there may be an issue that a lot of people in Juneau feel like we have to solve the entire problem at once. I would argue that there is no silver bullet, and you can't solve this crisis overnight, just like we didn't get here overnight. Much like when many years ago, after giving birth to a child, I had a lot of weight to take off. I didn't gain that weight overnight. I knew I was going to have to take little baby steps in small changes to get the weight off. It's sort of the same concept here. So we don't think that passage of this bill in and of itself is going to solve the entire problem, but we do think that it will, over time, have an effect in bringing health care costs down because consumers, again, will have the tools that they need to behave like consumers so that we can start to have an effect here and then look at other tools and resources and perhaps bills that need to be passed to give consumers those tools as well. So, again, I would like to ask your support in passing House Bill 123 so that as members of the committee, you can all go home and tell your constituents that this is one small step that you helped to make for us to deal with this, find a solution to this Alaska problem. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Terry, very much. Thank you for taking your time to testify. We're going to go to Elizabeth Warlick in Fairbanks.
Yes, thank you, Chair Coghill. Thank you to the committee for hearing our comments today. My name is Elizabeth Warlick, and I'm calling in from the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. I am the advocacy coordinator for our member businesses. We represent over 700 businesses here in the interior. And what we would like to say is that with regard to House Bill 123, we absolutely support market transparency, information availability, and we also support the role in government to bring the cost of health care into balance. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth, very much. Very concise, very well done. Thank you. We're going to go to Dr. I think it's Kobylars, if I got it correct, Dr. Thomas Kobylars in Soldotna.
Yes, hello. My name is Tom Kobylars. I'm in Soldotna. I'm calling representing myself, and I'd like to thank you for an opportunity to testify with the committee here. First of all, my family has an average health care cost of around $70,000 per year. I know the financial burden of health care is high for most of us. Thankfully, due to our health insurance, our actual health care expenditure is around $30,000. I appreciate the effort in your part to try to control costs. I believe in the disclosure of health care costs. 4 years ago, I wanted a physical exam. I contacted five different clinics and asked what the cost would be for a routine physical exam at each clinic. I had a high deductible plan, and so I told them what I wanted to know, or I asked them what the price would be, not accounting for insurance. I was given five different quotes over the phone. The only issue I had with my quotes was the different lab tests that I would need. Each quote was given off of a, sorry, I lost my place here.
Okay.
I did find the price difference interesting. I will say that the experience, I'm sorry, wasting my guys' time. Okay, the exam that I chose to have was about 1 hour in length. The other exams were about 10 minutes. Other exams I've had in my life have been about 10 minutes. So there's a difference in the quality of health care. The biggest problem that I have in my private practice comes from the insurance companies. We oftentimes ask for pre-authorizations, and the pre-authorizations, when we go to bill, we're not paid as we were promised. And so I think that it's frustrating to a provider, and it's also frustrating to consumers. I do believe in healthcare transparency. I do believe in disclosure healthcare costs, but I don't want to put a menu-style poster in my office to describe what the cost will be for each procedure. I don't think that's going to lower the prices of the procedures. It's not going to lower anything, just make my office look different. Anyway, I'm okay. Thank you for your time.
Doctor, thank you very much for taking the time out of your life to come testify here in front of the committee. is valued and appreciated. We're going to go to Heather Willis, who's with the Alaska Dental Society in Fairbanks.
Hi, my name is Heather. I'm Dr. Heather Willis from Fairbanks, Alaska. I am in general practice. I grew up in Delta Junction. I moved back to Fairbanks, where I enjoy it immensely. I am also representing the Alaska Dental Society. I am their current Developmental Affairs Chair. So overall, we do appreciate the intent of this transparency bill. As a consumer, again, just like Dr. Kolarz had just mentioned, as a consumer, it is very frustrating when you are going to a provider and you cannot get even estimate of what your out-of-pocket expenses will be. However, coming from the dental industry, we, as a very frequent practice, give our fee estimate, and we can give it fairly with fair certainty. And so we have no issues with that part of the bill. We do have concerns with posting the top 25 procedures with the fees. For the most part, you will find, and this is probably within dentistry as well as the medical community, that those highest fees that the consumer will see will be from specialists. However, how will they know that it is a specialist and not a general dentist or even a primary care provider? This is going to skew it and be very misleading for the patients who might go to the wrong or more unqualified provider based on these fees. To me, this is inferring to the consumers that healthcare is a commodity, and it is not gas or oil. We are dealing with humans and their healthcare and the value of the service. For the most part, we feel that this transparency bill definitely is a step in the right direction for consumers overall. However, I think there is going to be unintended consequences if this transparency bill passes. I want to say thank you to Chairman for allowing me to speak. And if there are any questions, I am more than willing to answer any.
Questions? No questions at this point. Heather, thank you very much for taking the time to come before us and testify and your interest in this bill. We're going to go to Anchorage at this point to Graham Glass.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes, fine. Very fine. Thank you. Put your name on the record. Give us your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Cargill, for allowing me to testify. This is Graham Glass. I'm a neurologist and the past president of the Alaska State Medical Association. I'll be very brief. I would like to applaud Representative Sponholz for pushing for transparency in healthcare for all the reasons that everybody's discussed. I think to add a little bit even more to it, when people are the most vulnerable, particularly in our neurology office, people are under a lot of stress with diagnoses that they may have gotten, and it's even harder sometimes to ask the right questions and go through all the things that you need to go through to get the information you need about healthcare costs, which are not on the top of your mind when you've just been told you had Parkinson's or ALS or something like that. So I think it's extremely important that we are transparent. I'm strongly in favor of good faith estimates. We've been doing that at our office, and it's been extremely helpful both for patients, and we've been a little bit proactive about doing it, and that's often quite appreciative. Further, it helps us in the end, because patients who get surprise bills don't like to pay them often, and it creates problems for everyone. And it's just not good business practice, and it's not super ethical either. So I'm really supportive of that. I think the one area where I have concern is with the sort of list price of what I consider sort of rack rates for services. If you look around Anchorage, you'll see, you know, for example, our sleep labs. An in-lab sleep study costs between $4,000 and $6,000 at most, you know, hospital facilities or other facilities. And negotiated rates with insurance companies range anywhere from $1,800 to $4,500 or something like that. And they're all over the place.
the thing that's interesting is that the rack rates almost never reflect what's going on underneath, which is what the patients actually will pay for their contracted rates. Now, that the vast majority of providers in Alaska are coming into network with Aetna, Blue Cross, et cetera. And so what I worry about is that it's a little bit misleading in terms of what transparency actually means. I had pushed originally to really say, you know, if you're going to do this and you need to provide useful and actionable information that isn't misleading to patients. And I think from my perspective, having, you know, contracted rates publicly available, which obviously leads to other legal hurdles, and is sort of difficult to do, would be the most valuable. But this step, or that component of this bill, I think that step isn't a step in the right direction, because it does provide misleading information, although I do feel the good faith estimates, et cetera, are. And I think looking at an amendment or another way in which you could say something like, you know, no contracts with providers are allowed to have non-disclosure clauses and more, such that we can post our contracted rates and allow consumers to really know what they're going to pay, and put some of that burden on insurance companies as well, would be much more useful for insurance companies at the end of the day. So all in all, I really applaud the efforts of this bill, because I think it is super important to have transparency in the marketplace, both as a person who's dealt with healthcare costs from the consumer side and dealing with my patients who I have to look in the eye and you know that I'm doing right by them. So it is important. I applaud the efforts and wish that a little bit of this was different and a little bit more constructive. But I do think the good faith estimate component, et cetera, is extremely beneficial. So I won't waste you guys' time anymore, but I really appreciate you guys listening. Thank you very much.
Dr. Glass, thank you very much. Some very valuable input. We're going to go next to Anchorage to Rhonda Prowell-Kidder, who is the Alaska Sustainable Healthcare Cost.
Good afternoon, Senator Coghill. My name is Rhonda Prowell-Kidder, and I am the Chief Financial Officer of the Public Education Health Trust. My testimony today is as the President for Alaskans for Sustainable Healthcare Costs. We're a group of Alaskan employers who are concerned about the current healthcare environment and are working together to help the community understand and find solutions to the drivers that are affecting these rising costs, which in turn affect our employees' benefits and the individual premiums we are paying. Our employees work in the telecommunication, automobile, retail, financial services, and labor industries all across Alaska. We fully support HB 123, and we urge its passing. We are asking our employees to contribute more in their out-of-pocket amounts, increasing their higher deductibles. We are asking them to be informed consumers. A part of being an informed consumer is knowing the cost of services, and it starts at the rack rate. When I walk into Cars, or I walk into Fred Meyer's, their rack rate is widely published for me. I have that information. I may have a discount card. I may have a coupon in my pocket. Someone else may have negotiated a lower rate for me. But I know that rack rate. I know where it starts at. We strongly support HB 123, and we concur this is not the silver bullet. However, it is the silver BB that we need to see in our market. Thank you for your time today.
Rhonda, thank you very much for taking time to testify and your interest in the issue. We're going to go to Juneau to Amy Lujan. Did I get that right? Alaska Association of School Business Officials. Are you on the phone?
Hello.
Okay.
Yes, can you hear me all right?
I was looking for you in the room, but yes, we can hear you just fine.
Great. I was there yesterday, but couldn't run over today, so thought I'd call in. We were in your offices and testifying around the Capitol last week, the Alaska Association of School Business Officials, also known as ALASBO, and we were there along with our superintendent and principal colleagues. And a lot of the issues we focused on were regarding K-12 school funding. And it seemed like there's a recognition around the Capitol of the fact that there's a lot of cost pressures on school district. And so the flat funding results in a cut to services in education. So with regard to that, there's also an understanding that the high cost of health care is one of those cost pressures that are faced by Alaskan school districts and by all employers around the state. So the ELASBO members like to bring attention to bills that help school districts that don't necessarily have fiscal notes. And this House Bill 123 is one of those bills that we believe can help school districts with these cost pressures, along with other employers and health care consumers who are all struggling here in Alaska with the high cost of health care. No, it won't solve the problem, but hopefully it will help healthcare consumers become better consumers and thereby possibly bend that cost curve a little bit. So I urge you to support this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Amy. I appreciate your work and your time and interest in this. Now in the room, we will go to Jeannie Monk with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Association. So thank you, Jeannie.
Hi, thanks. For the record, I'm Jeannie Monk with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. I want to start by thanking the bill sponsor for working with us during the development of this legislation. We appreciate the open process and her willingness to work with stakeholders. We've worked extensively with her and other committees on this bill over the past year and a half. I'll keep my comments really brief. We support price transparency. As others have mentioned, it's important to have realistic expectations for what it will achieve. But we believe this is a reasonable first step to take. We appreciate the change in the CS to remove the posting of Medicaid prices. We do not see value in requiring the posting of Medicaid prices and have testified about that. Medicaid payment rates are set through a negotiation between the state and the provider. They're already published by the state and could be made publicly available. I believe there's already a website where they can be found. So that that change we support. We support the good faith price estimates. Hospitals have systems in place to help patients get estimates for planned procedures. We've talked with our members about this around the state, and they believe they can comply with this legislation. Finally, while it seems that the hospital or provider would have access to the most important information to help consumers understand price, the insurer is often has access to the best data. For those with insurance, working with their insurer is the best way to get accurate information on what services will cost, what their out-of-pocket expenses will be, and to make sure that their provider is part of the insurer's network. Insurers often have access to price information for many providers in a region, and they can use that information to help their members factor in price when they are planning for a procedure. We appreciate the work this committee and the legislature is taking. We see this as a first step towards transparency. We do not expect this bill alone will lower health care costs, but we look forward to working with you and others on this initiative and others that can help consumers. And I would just highlight one website you might want to take a look at that has been talked about. It's called fairhealthconsumer.org. It's a nonprofit price transparency website. That is an example of what can be done to make price transparency information meaningful, not in a provider or insurance company specific way. So thanks for.
Would you repeat that?
It's fairhealthconsumer.org.
My listening and writing didn't catch up with each other, so.
Thank you very much.
Jeannie, thank you very much for your time. We also have here with the Alaska State Medical Association, Joseph Roth.
Thank you, Senators, for the opportunity to speak. If we're getting your committee chair wrong, can I just call you governor now? My name is Joseph Roth. I'm a family physician here in Juneau, as well as the president-elect of Alaska State Medical Association. I was born in Palmer and raised in Sitka. I'm here to say that we, the Alaska State Medical Association, supports transparency in medicine and ongoing work on improving health care and the cost of health care. We support good faith estimates on health care costs by physicians as well as insurers, but we do not support the listing of undisclosed or undiscounted charges by providers. This portion, the undiscounted charges portion of House Bill 123, is one of those cases where a little bit of information is about almost worse than no information at all. Undisclosed charges do not represent what patients are actually going to pay. What patients pay is based upon their type of insurance, and whether their particular provider is in-network or out-of-network. Most procedural charges cannot be listed as a simple and accurate manner because changes in descriptions of procedures can lead to marked changes in charges. An example would be if you go to a provider and you say, hey, I've got an ankle fracture, what's that going to cost me? It depends really on what they're going to do to your ankle. Are they just going to put it in a cast? Are they going to put pins in there? Are they going to open it up? Are they going to put plates? So there's a wide disparity. And so just saying, what is my cost for an ankle fracture is not that helpful. Another problem is that studies show that posting charges by physicians actually leads to an increase in overall healthcare costs, as physicians are then able to see what other providers are actually charging, and price discrepancies narrow, but when in an upward fashion, not in a downward fashion. Also, medical billing is a very complicated process. My office of 15 providers has 3.5 billers, and they are always available to discuss with patients the cost of their medical care based on their insurance type. So the Alaska Medical Association and I support good faith estimates, both from providers and insurers, but we feel that actually an all claims database would serve patients more fully. And this means both insurers and providers having full disclosure of their prices. And in closing, I'd like to say that I don't think this information, if you had an undisclosed charges list, I don't think any of you should use this information for trying to figure out what your healthcare costs were going to be. And so I encourage you to talk to your provider and your insurance company to actually get accurate information. Any questions?
Joseph, thank you very much. That was my concern as we started down this road. I came into this conversation way, way late. But that was my first question. And working with the sponsor, I think we've come with some kind of an agreement that we might make that information a little more valuable. But I think having the rack price is going to be a big part of having one end of the conversation, knowing that everybody else is probably going to be in some kind of a provider network. And then having that network described so that people can get a good faith estimate.
And we agree. It's not going to be an onerous thing for us to do. We just worry that patients are really not going to get the information that they really want. And so if you really need to involve the insurers, and I notice that the insurers are getting, you know, out of this, which is a little disingenuous. It's really hard for us as insurers to tell you what our prices are, but it's not hard for me. I don't think it's hard for the insurers to do it as well.
But we're getting the insurance in. We just we found out that we're not going to be able to get some of the information from them that we had originally thought to require. So you were the last testifier at this point, so I felt more at liberty to have questions with you. I did have an amendment brought before us, and Jordan, did everybody on the table get one? Did you pass out? And would you be willing to... what I need you to do is explain it. And this is one man's attempt at trying to figure out how to make this information more valuable. So I talked with the sponsor, and it expands the requirement a little bit. So those of you who would be required to do this, you might want to listen in carefully. It expands it, but I think it also makes it more valuable because of the conundrum that I had was, how do we make this information valuable? It still leaves the small docs offices, if they only provide less than these, that they only have to provide what they do. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to propose the amendment, but first, before I do that, I would like to have it explained. Will you indulge me, committee members, to have an explanation to this? And then maybe we could have Representative Spahnholz give some testimony to this. And if we feel that it has to be held over, we have been given the latitude of having one more meeting on Monday. But if we can dispatch this today, I'd like to. So, Jordan, would you just explain the substance of this amendment, please?
For the record, Mr. Chair, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. As you may have heard through some testimony, there's been some ongoing concern that just simply listing the 25 most common procedures could end up being a list that consists mainly of admissions codes or diagnostic codes that might be less relevant to some patients. And so in an effort to make this data more relevant, we actually looked at language from a bill in the Senate that did actually provide for the posting of the most common procedures and services within the six different CPT categories. And so that's what this amendment does, and we think that it would make the posting more relevant because it would exclude many of the admissions codes, consultant codes, and diagnostic codes.
The reason I wanted to bring it up is we had talked about it, but it wasn't part of the CS because it came to us throughout the conversation of today as I'm scrambling looking for better answers and to answer some of the objections that we kept running into. So, Representative Sponholz, could you come forward and explain how you might see this? And then I think probably what I could do is we could take the amendment if you're willing to. We could hold the bill over till Monday if there's other comment that needs to come forward, or we could move it forward.
Is this one better?
Yeah, that's a better microphone. Sorry, Representative.
Oh, no, that's fine.
Please, we've talked about this a little bit. Give us your sense of this.
Yeah, we have, so Chair Coghill, for the record, Representative Ivy Sponholz, District 16 in East Anchorage. So, you know, conceptually, this amendment works, and, you know, upon sort of, I'm gonna surprise you a little bit here, so I'm giving you a heads up. You know, this amendment works and makes a lot of sense when you're talking about hospitals. Unfortunately, the legal definition of healthcare facility is any practice in the state of Alaska that has more than one healthcare provider,
sure.
And that includes a lot of practices. And so you're talking about dental practices, you're talking about OBGYN, you know, women's clinics, you're talking about a whole range of healthcare providers, some of which don't provide these services. So many of them, you know, wouldn't have anesthesiology or, you know, radiology or surgery, for example. Some of them would. So that's my only concern with it. And you know, working on this bill over the last, you know, couple of weeks together, I think you've learned a lot about the complexity of healthcare system and healthcare billing and the way it operates, and trying to find something that works for everybody has been very complicated, which is why we landed on that 50 most frequently offered services, because we felt that that was simple enough that we could implement it. You could implement it in any healthcare setting. It didn't really matter which one. So I think, you know, the spirit of the amendment and the concept is good. I'm a little concerned about the applicability in different kinds of settings.
Senator Wilkowski had a question.
Yeah, what are the six sections of Category 1
sure.
sort of procedural terminology?
The six sections are evaluation and management, anesthesia, surgery, radiology, pathology, labs, and medicine. You can see it's a pretty broad range, and it makes sense. It's very relevant and applicable if you're talking about a hospital's, you know,
right.
scenario, but there's only, you know, there's pretty much a small number of hospitals in the state of Alaska. We want to make sure that whatever legislation we put in place, you know, serves patients who go to those hospitals, but also serves, you know, the vast majority of people who don't go to a hospital, or we hope never go to a hospital, and are just going to their local provider, their dentist, their doctor, other kinds of, you know, healthcare providers.
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to offer the amendment at this point, mm-hmm. but I am going to lay the bill aside, and Monday we'll bring it back up.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted people to take a look at this.
Mm-hmm.
There's we can go back to the 50 in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But the 25 is, in my view, a relevancy problem.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's some methodology between mm-hmm. those two concepts that we can iron out a better process.
Chair Coghill, I also have some samples that we've received from members of ASHNA
mm-hmm.
that show you what the top 50 are at a couple of different healthcare facilities in the state of Alaska, to sort of, which might help be helpful for you to consider when looking at this.
And so this is the last committee referral to this bill. Mm-hmm. It goes to the rules chairman, who is reluctant to have meetings to change anything. So I wanted to work with a representative. My first answer was no, terribly no. And then, as I said, I've been convinced to move on. The testimony is overwhelming that we have to start getting the consumer engaged in the process. And the cost and the structure, the cost and quality are big questions yet. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a consumer thing that they're going to have to be aware of. Mm-hmm. So, Representative, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to offer the amendment. We'll hold off. We have a template bill. I'm going to remove my objection to adopting this CS so we can work off of this CS. Mm-hmm. And then as we get input from other people, we'll work with you. Our Monday meeting is a Monday afternoon meeting.
All right.
We'll just take it up at that point. So at this point, what I'm going to do is lay House Bill 123 aside and thank everybody for their time and attention. And it's just out of respect to the industry and the sponsor that I want to keep working on trying to find this one solution if we can. With that, we're going to take up House Bill 259, which is confining vehicle loads. And my staff has a CS. Let me take a brief of these real quick. Call the meeting back to order. And my intention today is to bring up House Bill 259. We have the sponsor here, but I wanted to bring up a CS. I'll object to it. If I could have the sponsor come up, we have the sponsor here, Representative Stutz. And we have Department of Law. There was one issue in this that the Department of Law brought, and it was my understanding, Representative, that it was something that you also wanted to repair in this.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Senator Cockrell.
Right.
Representative Louise Stutz.
So it's the version G, is it?
Version G, that's correct, Mr. Yeah. Chair.
So. Senator Costello, could I have you make a motion to it?
Which bill number?
We're moving rather fast. We have a lot of paper on the desk, so.
Okay.
It's the CS for 259 Judiciary.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill
259?
259 version Gulf before the committee as the working document.
And I'll object, and we'll have Jordan Schilling give us his best shot at it, and then we have Diane Wendland that from the Department of Law that can help us with this.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to you. I had anticipated being able to digest Department of Law's explanation for the reason we are removing a provision from this bill in the CS. Having read it, it looks like a complex area of law. Diane Wendland is on the phone, but just so I can point to the members, in version S, the bill that came to the committee, contained language on page 2, starting at line 24. That's subsection E, and that's what's being removed, and that's what Diane Wendland from the Department of Law can speak to.
Diane, thank you very much for listening in to the committee. And the removal of this section, which is the E section on the S version, is for what reason?
Yes, thank you, Senator Coghill. This is Diane Wendland from the Department of Law, Office of Criminal Appeals. I'm assuming you can hear me okay?
Very well. Thank you, Diane.
Okay. Thank you. We had a couple of concerns about this. The primary one has to do with essentially burden shifting and using, essentially what this is doing is using the proof of one fact, that is the prior conviction, to prove another fact, which in this case would be criminal negligence. And the primary concern is that there's really not a close enough connection between the prior violation and the proof of criminal negligence in the current case. And the reason is there are just too many variables, in factual variables, in proving criminal negligence. And I think the best way to illustrate this is to look at some of the other examples of this type of thing in the other statutes that I believe Legislative Legal had come up with a number of examples where there really is a close connection. So, for example, if we have to prove that a defendant knew that he had an obligation to register as a sex offender, proof that he's been convicted of it before is a very direct and close connection with the fact that we're trying to prove, which is that he knew about it now. So that's where we're starting out. And here, where you have someone who's been convicted, 5 to 8 years ago for an act of what was found in the past to be criminal negligence, may have turned on the type of load, the type of means that were used to hold that load down, the type of vehicle that was being used, the route that was going to be traveled. There are all of these different factual things that may affect whether or not a person disregarded a substantial risk. What the risk is really depends in each case on very specific facts. And so if you tie the finding of criminal negligence in a prior case with the current one, what you're really doing is saying, okay, if we're not requiring any sort of similarity between the two, you have effectively shifted the burden to the defendant to show why these aren't similar, and that's generally not allowed. Which brings us to the other problem that we're concerned about, which is that without that requirement of similarity between the past event and the current one, you are essentially saying that we are going to find criminal negligence based strictly on propensity. That is, it's essentially saying this defendant was careless in the past, he's a careless person, and therefore we're going to presume that he was careless here. Now, certainly we are allowed under Evidence Rule 404B to present evidence of prior acts to the extent that they prove different things, such as the absence of mistake or knowledge, things of that type of character. But what we aren't allowed to do is just to say this is a bad person or this is a careless person, and that's enough to prove that they were careless or bad here. So that, I guess, is where our concerns lie. So if I can answer any questions, I'd be glad to, but that's it in a nutshell.
Diane, thank you very much. As a politician, I appreciate not having to have to deal with that shadow. That's my poor attempt at humor. Any questions on this particular issue, why we're taking it out of this particular bill? All right. Diane, thank you very much. I think you did a very good job of showing why we probably should not proceed on this. What I'm going to do now, then, is under this CS, I'm going to let the Representative Stutes take her best foot forward on why this bill and how it works and what will happen better in Alaska if this is passed.
Thank you, Senator Coghill, and thank you, committee members, for allowing me to present this bill. I brought this bill forward on behalf of an Alaskan who was grievously injured as a result of someone failing to properly secure their load in their vehicle. This bill addresses a serious gap in our confined load statute and will protect the safety of Alaskan drivers and pedestrians. In Alaska, even if you are seriously injured as the result of someone's negligence in securing their load, the current confined load statute only allows a $300 traffic infraction. Additionally, the current confined load statute only applies to sand, gravel, rock, or similar materials, leaving out a litany of objects that can injure or kill other drivers and pedestrians. This bill updates Alaska's confined load statute to include all materials that escape your vehicle with a few specific exemptions. It also requires maintaining 6 inches of freeboard or tarping loads consisting of sand, gravel, rock, or similar materials. It's a responsible public safety measure that will reduce injuries, fatalities, property damage, and roadway litter. And I will have my committee aide, Matt Greening, go over the specifics of the bill with you.
Yeah, Matt, you're going to take us through the sectional.
Through the chair, Matt Greening, for the record, staff to Representative Louise Stutz. I would be happy to, Mr. Chair.
What I'm going to do is at 3 o'clock, I'm going to shut you off. I'm going to ask indulgence from the committee. Can you stay for about 8 minutes while we give the next bill a chance to at least introduce itself? It'd be so at 3 o'clock, if you're not done, I'm done with you.
We'll be finished.
So, Matt, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So starting on page 1, or section 1 on page 1, line 3 through page 3, line 9, AS 2835251 is repealed and reenacted. Subsection A states that a person is guilty of a crime of failure to contain or confine a load in the first degree if, with the mental state of criminal negligence, they violate C, which is the simple violation, and as a result cause serious physical injury to another person. Criminal negligence applies to the act of securing the load, not some other way like you are driving or behaving in the vehicle, but to the actual act of you securing the load. Failure to contain or confine a load in the first degree is a Class A misdemeanor. Subsection B on page 1, lines 8 through 10, this subsection states that a person is guilty of the crime of failure to contain or confine a load in the second degree if, again, with criminal negligence, they violate the section and cause property damage of $5,000 or more. Criminal negligence, again, applies to the act of securing the load. This is a Class B misdemeanor versus what would be a Class A if it is serious physical injury. Subsection C1A, I and 2I, and Big B on page 1, line 11 through page 2, line 7. This specifies that a person who commits the offense of failure to contain or confine a load in the third degree, if a person drives or moves a motor vehicle loaded with any material on a highway unless it is secured or situated in a way that prevents it from escaping the vehicle or shifting to the extent that the vehicle's maneuverability or stability is adversely affected, and the load is treated by methods approved by the regulation through the Department of Public Safety that are designed to settle the load or remove loose material before it is driven on a highway. Failure to confine or contain a load in the third degree is an infraction. And I'd like to just briefly say that unless you have the criminal negligence and the serious injury, or the criminal negligence and the $5,000 or more in property damage, it's always a violation. Moving on to subsection C2 on page 2, lines 9 through 12, this specifies that a person may drive or move a motor vehicle loaded with sand, gravel, dirt, rock, or similar materials if at least 6 inches of freeboard is maintained around the perimeter of the bed, or the load is covered, and if the cover is used, it's securely fastened. With your permission, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time in getting through this, it's a short bill. I'm going to just start mentioning the subsections and skipping the page and line numbers. Subsection D1. This subsection is an exemption that specifies that provisions of this act do not apply to a vehicle that deposits sands, liquids, or other materials for the purpose of cleaning and maintaining or proving traction on the highway. This is out of current statute and just allows for maintenance vehicles to be sprinkling and spraying things out of their vehicle. Subsection D2, this is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of this act do not apply to commercial motor vehicles that are subject to federal motor carrier securement standards and implemented through state or federal law. Subsection D3, this is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of this act do not apply to the natural accumulation of snow, ice, mud, dirt, or similar materials. So if mud or snow or something similar flew off the top of your truck or out of the back of your bed and hit somebody, it's not a failure to contain or confine a load. Subsection D4 is an exemption that specifies that provisions of this act do not apply to a vehicle that is removing snow or hauling snow after removal. Again, this is DOT municipal vehicles that are dumping snow into dump trucks, transporting them the shortest route they can find to deposit the snow somewhere else. Subsection D5 is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of this act do not apply to random litter escaping the vehicle. Now, random modifies litter to make it clear that we're not talking about a load of litter, but strictly something that was put in the vehicle without conscious intent or method or decision. And we define litter in here specifically because litter, the only definition of litter in statute means waste materials, which could be something as large as an empty propane tank or scrap metal in the back of your truck, which could be dangerous. So we chose to define it as small, soft materials. Previous version, there was that prima facie look back that was removed. Subsection E1 on page 2 is a subsection that specifies that failure to contain or confine a load in the first degree is a Class A misdemeanor. Subsection E2 is a subsection that specifies that failure to contain or confine a load in the second degree is a Class B misdemeanor. F3A, B, C, and D. These specify the fine amounts for the infraction. So the difference between this and current law is right now it's $300 for the first infraction of a failure to contain or confine a load. We set in a sliding scale. So on the first offense, it would be $300, as is consistent with current statute. On the second offense, it would be $750. On the third offense, it would be $1,500. And then on the fourth offense, it would be $2,500. And then moving on to subsection F, specifies that criminal negligence in this section has the meaning of given in AS 1181-900, and I'd be happy to give you that definition if you would care for it, but I'll keep moving on for now. Section 2 on page 3, this is a conforming amendment to reflect the repeal and reenactment of AS 2835-251 in section 1 of the bill and the repeal of AS 2835-255. AS 2835-255 actually currently houses the penalties for violations of both of these statutes. I would like to point out that violating AS 2835-253 is currently an infraction. There's no substantive change in law here, but because we repealed the statute that housed the penalty for another statute, we had to reinsert that into the statute that in fact did have a penalty. And then Section 3 is what I was referencing, which is the repeal of 35255. And 35255 is just a section that deals with requiring people to have anti-spray devices such as mud flaps and fenders on vehicles. And with that, that was as expedient as I could make it, Mr.
Chair. Well done, and you hit it right on the nail. And I just wanted to get a chance for you to put your best foot forward. I'm sorry we had to do it in a rapid-fire fashion, but thank you very much. I'm going to lay the bill aside. We'll take it up Monday. If there's questions, amendments, or anything like that, Monday is the day.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, briefly, 336 by I think it's Representative Millett. Yes. And Hans Roderick, who I've become friends with down through the years. Representative, House Bill 336, please give your high-level introduction. We've probably only got about 7 or 8 minutes to do this. So,
thank you.
Give us your best shot at it.
For the record, my name is Sharice Millett, House District 25. Thank you for hearing this, and thanks for staying a little late to hear it. Supported Decision-Making Agreements Act is a way in which folks with intellectual developmental disabilities and seniors starting in the aging process can have an opportunity not to go to a full guardianship but have the flexibility of a supported decision-making agreement, which allows them to be part of the conversation on self-directing what happens in their lives and have a full discussion with people that they believe are what we call their supporters, whether it's friend, family, clergy, they can help them as they go through. Doesn't require full guardianship. And in the case of a person with an intellectual or developmental disability, it can taper down, so it can be a more supported decision-making agreement, and it can lessen as the individual becomes more self-sufficient. In the case of a senior, as seniors start aging, and all the things that comes along with aging, dementia, it can be more progressive and support them the other way. So it's a very flexible, supported decision-making agreement that keeps people out of the full guardianship, which is, you know, all or nothing in the guardianship world. So with that, I'll let Hans go through the specifics of the bill.
Representative, It's my understanding this fills a gap in that from a full guardianship to just allowing a little more flexible point. Otherwise, there's no other tool. That's I understand.
Correct. That's exactly what it does. Is it creates that in-between mechanism for folks that do need a little help in their lives when it comes to financial decisions, or any type of decision that you know they feel that they need a group of people around them supporting them as they go through the process. And it comes it's a bill that's gaining a lot of traction throughout the United States because full guardianships is just so onerous and doesn't allow individuals to have much say in what they're doing. AARP and the Governor's Council of Special Education and Disabilities, which I am a legislative member on, brought it forward as an innovative way to allow people to have, that autonomy that they need, but also feel supported as they go through their life.
Okay. Hans, you've got about 5 minutes to go through kind of a high level. You don't have to dig down in the details. Just give us the concepts in the sections.
Certainly, I'll, for the record, Hans Rodvik, staff to Representative Millett. I can see if I can kind of follow up on what Matt was able to pull through with the sectional. So the Supported Decision-Making Agreements Act, House Bill 336, there's three main sections to it. Under Section 1, there's a variety of subsections, and I'll quickly run through those. Under 1356.010, it's authorizing the adults to enter into a supported decision-making agreement and spells out the reasons why an adult may not enter one. 1356.20 describes the requirements adults must meet to be qualified as supporters in the agreements. 1356.30 sets out the parameters for what an agreement must contain to be legitimate, and it also deals with alternate supporters and the sharing of information amongst the supporters. 1356.40 lays out the requirements for an agreement to be valid and how the principal and the supporters may formalize the signing of the agreement. 1356.50 mandates that each supporter acknowledge their relationship with the principal and their responsibilities to support the principal. 1356.60 delineates who a witness to the signing of the agreement can and cannot be. 1356.70 clarifies when an agreement becomes ineffective and how long they last. 1356.80 deals details how either a principal or a supporter may terminate the agreement, and it likewise explains what happens if only portions of the agreement are terminated. 1356.90 is the general obligation of supporters. 1356.100 outlines the area of a principal's life, including health, finances, education, that a supporter may provide support in. Also provides a way for supporters to help the principal deal with health information covered under federal healthcare privacy laws. 1356.110 prohibits supporters from wrongly guiding and influencing the principal in a harmful manner. 1356.120 requires supporters to keep all information confidential and shielded from unauthorized use. 1356.130 directs people who interact with the principals and supporters to recognize the communication of the principal as if that communication or request was solely made by the principal. 1356.140 absolves a person from liability for following in good faith with an authorization under an agreement. 1356.150 deals with the circumstances in which a principal is capable and has capacity. 1356.160 spells out the affairs of a principal that a supported decision-making agreement may cover, such as work, health care, support services, etc. Following subsection deals with the multiple support services that are referenced in the previous section. And then in 1356.180, we've placed the statutory form, a model form for a supported decision-making agreement into statute. And there are 12 subsections to that, which, given the time frame, I feel a little crunched to run through those, but you basically lines out all of the requirements as spelled out in this previous statute of the bill of how a form is supposed to look. And the reason why we put the form into statute was to relieve the Department of Health and Social Services from the requirement to create those forms, given that these are private agreements. And then the following two subsections under Section 1 of the bill are the definitions and the short title as the Supported Decision-Making Agreements Act. Section 2 and 3 deal with amending Court Rule 402, Alaska Rules of Evidence, clarifying that the execution of a supported decision-making agreement cannot be used as evidence of a principal's incapacity.
Is this on a model act? Is this based off a model act?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, it's a relatively new area of law. There are not precise model acts, but the uniform code of law, or there's an association out there that deals specifically with guardianships and this type of disability legislation, they are now recognizing supported decision-making agreements as a legitimate alternative to guardianship and recommending that in their national legislation.
So as somebody who's taking care of a 92-year-old dad, just looking through this was very helpful, just for me. And so I'm going to lay this bill aside, and we'll probably take it up Monday. I would encourage the members of the committee to look at it. If there's questions on the liability question or anything that we can ask the sponsor, we'll bring this up. Looks like we're going to still have a fairly busy day Monday. So we're going to lay it aside. Thank you, Representative, for bringing the bill forward. Unfinished business on Monday is going to be House Bill 123. We'll take up 259, the confining of the motor vehicle loads, 336, decision-making agreements. And if we have some agreement with 208, we'll entertain that. So that'll be a busy day Monday. But at this point, I wanted to have it at least introduced so that you could start looking at it. Thank you very much for attending. Thank you for the committee for sticking with us through the extra 10 minutes. All right. With that, judiciary is adjourned.